Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode today of Life, the University, and Everything. This is the podcast of mostly academics sipping tea while discussing life's biggest questions. I'm your host, Kat Gonzalez, and I sat down with my friend, Dean Shaheem, an engineer turned anthropologist, talking about purpose and social justice and how to inspire change in the people around us. I first want to, apologizing is weird, but just note that on this episode and currently feeling a little sick and very tired, of course, as always, in true grad student spirit, hashtag authenticity. So just note that in case we're feeling a little bit low energy. I was also drinking some herbal tea, which may have really calmed me down. So next time, I'm going to be sure to drink a little bit of caffeine while recording. Note to self. But anyway, sit back, enjoy, and I hope you enjoy listening and asking yourself, why are we building this? What really matters? And how can we make the world around us inspire change? So, Dean, what are you drinking today?
You've got quite a selection of teas, so I was not sure. Oh, this is not even... Is that the one? I'm going to assume it was the one. But it was something called Karakuma.
Oh, okay, yeah, but, that's right.
But it was from India, and yeah. I did not know the name, and I figured I love Indian tea, so
awesome.
I'm quite enjoying it. It's very good.
Very nice. I'm drinking Honeybush Organic. It's a rooibos.
I love rooibos tea.
And it's so nice. It's so calming. And yeah, I like it a lot.
I feel like I used to think there was really just two kinds of tea in the world. And it blew my mind when, like, herbal tea. My parents had not drink herbal tea. Black tea or green tea. And that was...
Oh, okay.
And I remember one time my mom used to visit. My parents are both from Afghanistan, and they came. They would come to California a lot to visit my aunt, and we'd go to the Afghan shops and things like that. And for some reason, she bought gunpowder tea, like Chinese gunpowder tea.
Yeah.
And I think this is pre 9/11. I think I was probably like maybe 8 or something like that. But we were in the airport in San Francisco, and I always remember this. Like that, she had it in her bag, and the then version of TSA, whatever it was, like opens up the bag and says, "What is this?" And like. And it says Chinese gunpowder. Like, it's a box. It's this green box. It says Chinese gunpowder. Uh-huh. And the rest of it's all written in Chinese. Like, and nobody... And she, you know, just starts to interrogate my mom. She's like, what are you doing? And my mom's like, it's tea. And then she, you know, opens it up and looks, sniffs it. But it really, you know, I think nowadays, hopefully someone would be smarter. But most likely, but it would have been a much bigger deal. But back then, I was like, all right, just pack it up, go on the plane. So
good old days.
Anyway, I just...
Wow. That is a really, like, interesting first memory of tea. I don't even have first memories of tea. I grew up in Denver, which is near Boulder, which is home of Celestial Seasonings, and they don't sponsor this podcast, so whatever. But one of the field trips to the factory was really cool because they have this giant mint room. And, yeah, so they show you, like, the whole, like, production and stuff. And then they take you to the mint room, and it's just, like,
what's the burning. Mint room?
It's, like, burning your eyes. It's just, that's where they store the mint.
Oh, mint.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was really interesting. But, yeah, growing up, I didn't really drink tea that often, actually. I think I associated it with being sick.
I just associated it with my dad. He was like, you know, he'd be working in the yard doing something, and he'd say, you know, like, my contribution was basically bring him tea. So, like, it was, you know, and he would want, like, it didn't matter if it was the hottest summer day, he'd, like, want hot tea.
Whoa, okay. It's we drink a lot of iced tea.
Yeah. No, I mean, Afghans do not understand the concept of iced tea. I love iced tea, but not my parents think I'm crazy.
That's awesome. Aw. Well, let's get started with our first segment. Our first segment is called, What Did You Learn in School Today? So this could also be from the past week.
Okay.
So no pressure. We don't have to learn something every day. But yeah, what did you learn in school today?
Ooh, what did I learn in school today? Well, I think, I've learned that I'm not very good at keeping with deadlines.
Oh, yeah.
But that's, I mean, that's not something I learned that was quite that new. I think one of the most interesting things I learned this week was actually when these faculty from liberal arts colleges came to visit Stanford, and they were talking about their lives and what they did, and a lot of them seemed actually happy and quite, you know, they said they had a kid and they you know, they walked to school and that they, you know, and just that they weren't that stressed out and in comparison to their colleagues at other, you know, these research intensive universities. And it was one of the few times I think I've heard, you know, seeing that was kind of refreshing. I said, okay, well, it is possible to kind of have both.
Yeah.
And that was maybe not, it was more of a self-learning about what, you know, trying to reflect on, you know, what do we want? So that was one thing. I mean, there's probably many things, but that.
Yeah. Right there. I think that's really powerful. I think that's a really good connector to hopefully what we're talking about today. Which is why I'm super excited to have you on today. And
thanks,
like,
for having me.
Yeah. Totally. Sort of rewind the road of where you've been and like what matters to you. So do you want to start like at the beginning?
Sure. Okay. I guess, where is the beginning? So I'll start with my parents, because I think that's simple. My grandparents, I suppose. My entire family's from Afghanistan, and they, my parents came here in 1980, I believe. It was 1980. But going backwards a little bit, my mother's from a city called Herat in Afghanistan, and my father's from Mazar-e-Sharif. But he's really from a little village next to the town of that's Balkh, which is actually was ancient Bactria. So it was where the Alexander the Great ended up. But I think that was his last stand in the ancient world.
Wow.
And so my parents ended up, essentially fleeing the war that was started in 1979 through a proxy war between the United States and the Soviet Union. And they, for political reasons, could not stay. My dad was, basically at that point, even if my father was sympathetic to, was not sympathetic, I should say, to the king, and was sympathetic to broadly to the kind of leftist causes at the time. If he was not sympathetic to the purges and kinds of, real violence that was happening at the time, and neither was my mother. And my mother was out of the country. She was in Thailand at the time, and she got a letter from her parents basically saying, "Don't come back. Things are really bad here." And my father, I'll probably miss a detail here or there, but he basically found out from a friend of his that people were looking for him, that he had to leave. And so he left, basically as soon as he could to escape the country. And by that point, he'd already met my mother. They were already engaged, and they get married in a dorm room in Thailand. And, where my mom was studying a master's degree.
Okay.
And
I was going to ask what your mom was doing
in
Thailand.
She was in Thailand studying her master's in urban planning. And my father was a structural engineer, and they come to the U.S. together. After that, my aunt was already here, and my sister is born in Dallas, Texas. That's where they start their lives. And then we end up in Charlotte. That's where I'm born. But very quickly, we moved to Seattle. And I grew up in Seattle. I mean, that was basically where I was raised.
Yeah.
I don't know where else should
I go? That's interesting. Why Dallas originally, and why Charlotte?
They're random places. I mean, I think it was mostly, I think, where my aunt first, they came to Memphis, actually, that was the first place.
Oh, okay.
And that was because my aunt was already living there, and so they had a place to stay. But then my dad heard there was a building boom in Dallas, and he read in the newspaper, and he said, "Oh, there's jobs in Dallas." And at this point, you just call in the classifieds, and so they interviewed him over the phone, and said, "Why don't you come down?" So, and so he went to Dallas because of that. And I think Charlotte was a similar reason. And then finally, I think he read about Seattle in some new magazine and said it had great quality of living. And so he went first, and then my mom went along, checked it out, and they said, "Okay." So they decided to move. But awesome. I mean, that was not I shouldn't say that, but I think I'm glad, I think, that I grew up in Seattle, I think, in comparison to those two places, mostly because, after 9/11, it was a lot easier to be an Afghan-American in Seattle. I mean, at that point in Seattle, it was mostly, after 9/11, it was, a lot of liberal liberals who felt apologetic and kind of like they're like, I'm really sorry we're bombing your country. And I was like, yeah, I mean, but, you know, there's other ways in which, that's still better than, you know, some of my friends who, you know, even not very far from Seattle, you know, lost friends over, you know, after 9/11. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, it was unfortunate that I didn't know more about that at the time. I think, you know, I was often called on by, you know, my middle school teachers to explain Afghanistan, and I didn't know anything about Afghanistan. I mean, like I enjoyed the spotlight for that moment, so I tried to talk to people about what little I knew.
Do you remember 9/11 that day?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. Yeah, it'd be hard to not remember. I think most people in the country remember, but I think for me it wasn't. I don't think I understood the significance of it at that time, but I remember coming out of my bedroom. My mom, like, woke me up, and she's like, come look at the television. I think this is the way a lot of people on the West Coast especially learned about it, because we hadn't left the house yet, I think.
Right.
Right, so I think I was just getting ready for school.
Yeah.
And, but I didn't understand, you know, it was only until a few days later, a few months, I don't remember, when George Bush decided that he'd go after the Taliban, that it suddenly became much more relevant. Because at the time, it was just, I mean, we didn't know who was on it, on these planes, what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny, because I was... At the time, you know, I think I watched the History Channel all the time, and so I loved watching all these military. I loved military history. I was obsessed with it. And I should have known early on that I actually liked history more than I liked, you know, engineering, which is what. But I like
more on that later.
Right. But I was kind of, you know, I would say interested in a kind of history that now I would not. Yeah, as much, I suppose. But, you know, I was obsessed with the learning about American military machines and things like that. And so, you know, I remember when in 2003, when we went to war with Iraq, I was cheering. I was, like, excited. I told my parents, I said, you know, this is great. We have to, you know, we have to expand American empire, and we need to get oil, and that's okay. Like, this is like me at age, 14 at that point. And it was totally, I had just taken this neoconservative line from basically the television. I mean, I think... And, you know, by the time high school was out, I had become a sort of default liberal. I mean, I think my sister threatened to disown me, and I kind of I got over that. So
as one does, yeah.
Yeah, it was just, you know, you're stubborn 14-year-olds. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just want to have a contrarian opinion to everything.
Totally.
So, but it was interesting to think about how you can really absorb political ideologies from, you know, things that you don't realize. And so I think that... Without, it was only later on that I started to understand, like, when I learned more about the history of what my parents, you know, country went through and what they went through. I mean, then I started to understand why my father was so averse to, you know, they were so shocked when I said I wanted to support war. Because, you know, for them, war was not an abstract thing. It was the reason why my dad didn't see his brothers for, you know, 30 years, you know, and my same thing with my, a lot of my mom's family. So, it was, and I think that is... we can get to this later, but I think that's also a big reason of why I sort of became frustrated with engineering, because when I got to undergrad, I wanted to design planes. I wanted to design spaceships. I wanted to go to Mars. I mean,
did this interest start?
Ooh, I think it started. I mean, definitely when I was, I think it was since I was a kid, I was obsessed with sci-fi. I mean, I really, really wanted to...
Sci-fi and history and
sci-fi,
war.
Military history, and military history, military sci-fi in space, even better. That was my favorite. you know, but I also loved Star Wars, Star Trek. I mean, I was just a big giant nerd. I played computer games and I really thought, you know, I said, well, I'm going to build a spaceship and fly it. Like, that was my goal. I was going to be an astronaut, and I was going to be a pilot. And I think also that might have played into a little bit the desire to, like, be a fighter pilot at some point that I had, because I think that was also a way to become it's often a way to become an astronaut, because you fly planes. But then when I got to college and I started thinking about majors, I asked my mom... my mom told me that she knew an aeronautical engineer and that he could give me some advice, one of her old colleagues. And I remember sitting down with him for lunch one day, and he's, you know, a middle-aged white guy, but he's just like, yeah, you know, most of the jobs are in the defense industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, I don't think, you know, in retrospect, it makes more sense than I think it did in that time. But there was a way in which I was interested in, I was doing a research kind of opportunity for undergraduates in a lab at the time. I was 18. It was like the summer before undergrad. And I was working in this like plasma physics lab. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I mean, I could barely understand what a capacitor was. Like that was the extent of like what
yeah.
That's what I wanted to work on. I wanted to work, like, you know, do fusion plasma research, some, you know, design spaceships, you know, and make a warp drive. I mean, that was like what I was trying to do. And and when I learned that most of the jobs were in making missiles, I was like, I don't want to blow up people who could be my cousin. Like, you know, and that's because I, you know, for me, it was a, you know, even though I didn't know anybody in Afghanistan at that point, I hadn't met them yet. You know, there was still understanding that, you know, a good third or maybe even more or half of my family was in Afghanistan and was being bombed, you know, and not like directly them, but like, you know, their extended family, their friends. I mean, they were, you know, they were in cities for the most part, so they were spared to the worst of these things. But that was not what I wanted to work on. And so I thought, well, I'll be a civil engineer.
Yeah, so backing up a little bit, like, what was your childhood like growing up in Seattle? Did you have an Afghan-American community around, or was it just your family? Like, what were friendships like?
Yeah, no, there was no Afghan-American community really to speak of. I mean, there's a small one in Seattle, but it's not like the Bay Area or New York or even Virginia where there's... You know, really, you'll meet Afghans at school, you'll find Afghan grocery stores. I mean, there was, you know, also, this is the way you can describe how big the Afghan community is in Seattle. It's big enough that new migrants will come, be helpful, and open a bakery, and it will promptly close in about 6 months. Like, and this cycle has repeated 3 or 4 times. Because they think, they're like, there's maybe 500 families, 400 families spread across the area. Like, you know, it's enough that occasionally they'd have gatherings and we'd go, but... I was always sort of alienated from it because I didn't speak Persian. For whatever reason, you know, growing up, I think because I'm the younger brother, and you know, at that point, I had an older sister who I liked talking with, and she spoke in English. I spoke in English with her, and my parents didn't really want to force me to speak Persian because I was also at that time there was a lot of the early '90s. There was still this sense that being bilingual meant being bad at English, and it's like that's not. Like, now it's, like, totally the reverse. It's, like, put your kids in Mandarin school. And I was, like, you know, I wish I was...
Right.
Like, it would have been a lot easier to learn Persian as a kid.
Yeah.
But because of that, I was always, like, I'd go and, like, all the aunties and uncles would, you know, like, say, talk to me. And all I knew how to say was, like, hello, goodbye, I need to go to the bathroom, I'm hungry. Like, that was basically... and I would just mumble them. I didn't even know. I was, like, bamana khoda, you know, or, like, salam. I knew how to say salam And I was excited about the buffets. Like, I mean, I really like the buffet, but like the weddings with all the food. Like, but I think by the time I was maybe 10 or 12, a lot of those events sort of, we just stopped going anyway. Mm-hmm. And so, I went to a high school where there was basically the closest person, you know, ethnically to me was a couple of Indian students. But mostly it was Chinese Americans, white people, and African Americans. There wasn't really anybody else quite like me. I don't think there was... To my knowledge, I don't think there was a single Muslim American that I was really friends with. And I'm not, you know, I'm not even saying religious, it's just culturally anybody from that part of the world. I don't think there was anybody.
Wow. Yeah. So talk about Seattle as home. Is it home, or what does home mean to you?
Oh, yeah. I would say definitely Seattle is very much home. I think, though, that maybe it's... In some ways, it reminds me a little bit of what my parents described about Afghanistan, because for them, it was home, and they would always tell me stories about it, but when I tried to tell them I wanted to go there, I was like, I want to go visit. They're like, Dean, it's not the Afghanistan of our stories. And I mean, that's like the much more extreme version, but like, but I still feel like, in a tiny way, like, Seattle has changed so much in the past 2 decades that, like, it's, you know, since, you know, even just past decade, I mean, I forget the 2 decades, that it's not... Some parts are just irrecognizable. Like, I mean, it's like a lot of the, you know, the grungy funkiness of Seattle that I remember. I mean, it's feels like it's a lot of it's gone. I mean, I think there's still traces of it, but it's sort of spread out now. People have had to move to the south end, to the and to places north, you know, farther away. So I lament that. I mean, we'll see. I'm trying to live there and see how it is. I think it's the most beautiful city in the country. I mean, there's still like things I love about my family's there. So to answer your question, home is where my family is. And so they're there, so that's home. I mean, that's, you know, I think ultimately that's it. But I think that it doesn't feel like the place I grew up.
Yeah. So did you apply to many places other than the UW?
Undergrad.
Was that like your top choice?
Right.
Or,
Well, it's interesting. you know, I went to, I was tracked into this gifted program in Seattle, which I now recognize has a lot of problems, I think, you know, to say the least. And, you know, I had a friend, one of my good friends always would tell me that there were a lot of problems, but I didn't quite get it then. But, you know, I mean, just suffice to say that giving more attention to people who already are doing well is not the way our society should function. And, but that said, I was tracked into this program with a lot of upper middle class kids. And I should say, you know, I kind of grew up middle class, you know, I'd say like, you know, the formative years of my life, you know, when I was an adolescent or kid and adolescent, my parents were, you know, very much middle class, like, you know, both had professional jobs, but weren't, you know, we didn't have, they came here with $500 in their pocket. I mean, so it wasn't like they had a huge inherited wealth at that time. But then as they, you know, as time went on, they were able to buy a house. And so I think kind of felt like I moved into this upper middle class. But I didn't have that. It wasn't the same as a lot of my peers who were clearly from like the, you know, if you don't know Seattle geography, you know, they're from Laurelhurst and Ravenna and you know, Ballard and Magnolia and these sorts of places that are sort of, you know, generally speaking, bastions of, you know, well-to-do white liberal folks who are very nice and like, and but, you know, there was, you know, I remember going over to the houses of friends who had, whose parents had gone to Harvard or, you know, liberal arts schools I'd never heard of before. And I don't mean in any way to like say that I couldn't have applied to those places and maybe even have gotten in, but I just didn't even know. Right. It wasn't something that I, you know, I had a lot of privileges. I mean, there was, you know, to even be in that school, to have those teachers, and, and both my parents were, you know, both had master's degrees. So, I mean, but they had master's degrees in another country, another system where, you know, just, they did, you know, the person who guided me through a lot of this was my sister. And she went to UW, and I'm very grateful that she explained to me how this all worked, because otherwise it would have been quite confusing.
Yeah.
But I watched all my friends applying to Wellesleyan and Williams and, you know, Haverford and places that now I recognize would actually be interesting places to teach. But although I think I'd rather teach in a public university. But to answer your question, I only applied to UW because it was in Seattle and it was also just the most economically obvious choice. And then I applied to the UCs mostly because my aunt was in Berkeley. It was not she was in Berkeley, but she was in Walnut Creek. And then since you could fly to Berkeley and UCLA and UC San Diego and all in one application, I was like, I'll just check the boxes and see what happens. And then I applied to Stanford and did not get into Stanford. which made it all the more funny when I came here later as a graduate student. I was like, this is weird. You know, I remember I came to visit Stanford with my aunt just because she was like really wanted. She was really, you know, angling for me to come to the Bay Area. And we came to visit. And I think I mostly just saw the Stanford Shopping Center. Like I saw the mall and I was like, what the hell is this? I don't want to go to school at the mall. Like, this is dumb. Like, I think I also saw the statues at the Rodin School. But, like, I just didn't
want to go to school at a museum.
Yeah, it just was not, you know. And so, anyway, the point was I didn't get in there. And that would have been a place maybe that would have offered more financial aid. But and then going to Berkeley just seemed like, yeah, it was maybe academically a little better than UW. But not four times more expensive better. So, in-state tuition at that time was more expensive, but still reasonable. It was more while I was there that they started, you know, ramping up the costs.
Okay.
So.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to put my parents into debt, and it made sense to
go somewhere. And how ahead of you in years was your sister?
She was 5 years in school ahead.
Okay. That's a nice
five or gap. Six. Yeah, no, so she had, like, by the time I was even applying, I think she'd finished and graduated from the UW, was, like, on her way to like having the awesome job she has today. Oh, awesome. So yeah. So she was definitely like a trailblazer in that regard and figured it out when I would have otherwise been like, wait, how does this all work?
Right. So that's super cool. Cool. So then you arrive at UW, you're going around seeing how to be an astronaut.
Right.
At that point, you want to do, okay, civil engineering. But like, so why civil engineering?
So it wasn't, I think, actually now that I think about it, it was maybe a little bit into my first year that I switched to civil engineering. I mean, at that point, it's not really switching. It's just switching where you want to be. At that point, you're just taking chemistry, you know, 101 and math 101. Like, you know, those sorts of intro classes with 700 people in them, which are great.
Do not miss those days.
Great ways to wash out lots of, you know, brilliant people. And, you know, so I was halfway through, and I think this is very funny. My mom actually points to this as a turning point in my life, which I didn't even realize was that I heard about, I heard about Engineers Without Borders, and I got involved, just went to a couple of meetings, because, like, honestly, I think it was just, I wanted to go travel to Bolivia, because it sounded like you could go, like, and I had never, I'd only, out of, at that point in my life, I'd been to Mexico on like a really embarrassing, it's embarrassing to say this, I went on like a cruise once with my family. Mm-hmm. That was like the only time I'd really left the country, there in mm-hmm. Canada. And obviously on a cruise, you don't really see much of an actual country. So yeah. I was just like, yeah, the idea of traveling, I was, you know, I was 18, I was excited. Mm-hmm. And, you know, vaguely helping sounded good. I mean, I really did not think I thought about it very much. And I started to go to meetings, and then it happened to be that year. This was in 2007 going on 2008, and they had a national conference for Engineers Without Borders at UW, like hosted at UW, and it was the same weekend my best friends from that year were all going to drive up to Banff in like Canada to go I don't know if it was hiking or skiing or something fun. And I told my mom, I came home on the weekend, and I was like, Mom, you know, what should I do? Like, my friends are going to Banff. It sounds fun. Or there's this conference for Engineers Without Borders. And my mother, being a good, you know, good immigrant mother, says, do the educational thing. Like, and, you know, and avoid, you know, winding roads in, like, Canada. So go to the conference. And so I was like, okay. So I went to the conference, and it, you know, totally changed. I mean, it was, I saw all these people who were, you know, I learned about why this all mattered. I mean, I learned about, you know, some extent about, oh, there's people who don't have clean water. There's people who, you know, and there are people doing good things. And I saw these people who came to give talks. And I was like, oh, I want to be like them. Like, that sounds important. Mm. And again, I still don't recall really having great, you know, very detailed thoughts. Mm-hmm. But I realized that almost all of them were civil engineers, because that's, you know, in terms of engineering for humanitarian purposes in the global south, it's civil engineering is probably the most, you know, it's the most basic things that you need. Water, mm-hmm. roads, sanitation, houses. And so I decided, no, I want to do civil engineering. And I think it started to make me, I think even before that, I'd started to like question the purpose of space travel. You know, I just sort of wondered, what is the point when we are just, you know, this world is burning up? What are we doing? I mean, it just didn't, you know, and especially put in context of like saying, okay, well, we don't have, you know, learning about how people didn't have clean water and basic things. And I was like, people are spending billions of dollars really to like launch one rocket into space and to do, you know, and I don't know that I'd be hardline against doing anything in space, but like it's incredibly important for science and our understandings and even the way the world works with satellites and whatnot. But I thought my dream of just traveling for the sake of traveling seemed kind of flippant or something at that moment, or like or kind of out of touch, maybe a little bit like Jeff Bezos.
So maybe even like I'm noticing, like, did you maybe want to be an astronaut, like space travel for the sake of space travel, and then sort of like transitioning that desire for like travel to like global south for the sake of travel, just because it's like cool, right, initially, or like,
yeah, I guess a desire for adventure in some ways. I don't think of myself as always necessarily that adventurous a person, but I think that in that regard, yeah, I think so. But then, you know, so the justification came later. It wasn't like, you know, like it wasn't like I learned that this is important and I did it, and I was just like, you know, I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that you know, I started playing the cello because I had a crush on a girl, you know, like, I mean, in fourth grade. So it's like, you know, I you know, we don't always have, then I started to like the cello, but it was, you know, a lot of my life has been, you know, me doing something maybe for the wrong reason and then learning that, oh, actually there's a good reason to do it. So it's not always planned out in advance.
I like what you mentioned, like your mom identifying this as perhaps a turning point.
Right.
So how do you think that connects to what matters to you now?
Right. So I was very involved with Engineers Without Borders. I go to Bolivia and, you know, and I look back at my journals and I don't think it's embarrassing to admit, but I think the thing that it was most surprising about visiting this like very rural community in near Cochabamba, well, not near, 6 hours on windy roads away from Cochabamba, was, you know, there was a way in which, you know, this community, which had almost basically subsistence level of income, they reminded me of the stories my dad would tell me about his village. And I know that they were completely different places, you know, different times, different, I mean, just, you know, an anthropologist, I'd say this is ridiculous, Dean. Like, you know, but there was something that just, you know, I didn't have any other experience to grab, you know, to, I didn't have any other, you know, if you think about it, you have, you know, memories. They, you illustrate them based on something that, or in your dream, you illustrate mm-hmm. that dream based on real experiences or something that you had. So I had nothing else to, with which to link these dreams and sort of what seemed like dreams to me, these stories of, you know, his childhood making, you know, cars out of his own clay, like with like sticks. I mean, like just mm-hmm. that kind of, you know, put it some way in simplicity. Like I didn't know, I had never experienced in my life. And so, and seeing people's happiness in that, you know, in that moment. I mean, I know that, and I could tell you about all the problems in those places too. And but there was a way in which, you know, I had been taught that like being poor in a place like that meant, you know, being miserable. I just expected people to be frowning all the time, and they weren't. They like were giggling and having fun, and like, I mean, it's just
interesting.
This is completely ignorant. But I mean, I think it's important to be honest about that. And so I came back from, and I remember that trip too. Before that, I was kind of embarrassing too. I was really obsessed with my appearance. Like, I mean, up until like, you know, like I was, at some point I wanted to be a bodybuilder. I wanted to, I was always shopping. I won best dressed in high school, which looking back at my clothes, I was like, why did I win that? I was terribly dressed, but like very gaudy, just like a little bit over the top. You know, and after, and during that trip, I couldn't shower for 3 weeks, and, like, we were, like, in the woods. And I also had that outdoorsy side, too, so I was a little bit, that was okay, but I had kind of separated that from my normal identity. But in that moment, I, you know, I was just, we were there for 3 weeks in this village camping, basically, working on a road. And I think coming back, my mom, like, looked at me, like when I came, knocked on the door, and, like, she hadn't heard from me in 3 weeks, because I, we didn't really have cell phones or anything like that. And she just, like, I was, like, I looked emaciated to her. I don't know why. I think I just eaten potatoes for a long time. And I had a beard. And, like, she was just, like, what has happened to my son? And in some ways, I didn't really, I mean, I did shave sometimes after that. But it kind of, it just was a short transition to being, I, like, decided after that point that I was committed to doing, I wanted to basically save the world with, like, a, you know, hard hat, you know. And that was, I was going to be an engineer and do this the rest of my life. That was my goal. And I also, you know, kind of started to realize that a lot of the material things I had been really obsessed with were, you know, in many ways, stupid. And so, I mean, that was sort of on the personal level. And then on a professional level, I had kind of switched what I wanted to do. But it was then that following year that I started being interested, okay, I need to learn everything I need to learn about development. Like, this is what I need to do now. I'm interested in development, humanitarianism. And I took a class with a professor, a lecturer, Stephen Bezruchka, at the University of Washington in the Global Health Department. And, you know, he's one of my, one of the most important, probably the most important person I've met, like, along my sort of professional trajectory. Taking his class, it was a very innocuously named class called Global Population Health. And, you know, what, but the class was basically all about inequality, and it was all about how inequality was produced, what inequality, you know, in society, and how inequality affected, you know, I'm talking about economic inequality, social inequality, all kinds of inequalities, how inequality affected everyone, and, and not just the poor or the rich, not just the people on the top of them, also not just people on the bottom, but also people on the top. And, you know, he really pushed people to ask why this was the way it was, and if we couldn't imagine a different kind of society. And that class just, you know, week by week blew my mind. And I was completely, like, unsettled afterwards, because a lot of what we also learned was about how development schemes just simply hadn't worked, you know, and that there were, you know, and they hadn't worked because they didn't recognize that the reason why people were poor was political. It wasn't because of some lack of white people in, like, hard hats, or, in that case, I wanted a white person, but, you know, effectively, like, you know, first world, you know, person coming and building their roads, like, that wasn't why they were poor. They were poor because we had, you know, basically, you know, in the case of Bolivia, we had stripped all their mines of all the, I mean, not we as in a plural of the, you know, the global north, including Spain, in this point in case, had stripped their mines of everything they had, and in the 20th century had basically put them under debt regimes that meant that they were, you know, rather than hiring their own engineers to work on the roads that I was building, they were, you know, essentially just paying back loans to Wall Street bankers, and then I was coming in as this Westerner to come build their road. I mean, it was just absurd. I didn't understand the geology there. I wasn't even a real engineer. I mean, none of it made sense. And so after that, I said, "Well, shit, what am I doing?"
This is like two major turning points.
No, it was all in 2 years. I mean, it was pretty quick. And so immediately after that course, like, I asked Stephen, I was like, what should I do with my life? And, you know, and he wasn't willing to, like, give me a directive. He was like, you know, you should do what you're good at, and that you can do for a long time. I think those were his words. And, But, I mean, I think his implication was, you know, do something to help change the world. And I went to Nicaragua after that, and that was, I had this weird grant to travel and kind of study, essentially, or do basic field work about NGOs. And the point was not, that's not the most important part. The most important part was that I took two books with me. One was The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, which is about the nonprofit industrial complex. And, you know, basically, you know, punchline, rich people may not fund projects that would, you know, eliminate rich people. Like, that's not, like, and make a society that was egalitarian. Like, that's not really in their interest.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not, seems like, it does, you know, it's like a lot of these things are like elephants in the room. I mean, it's like, everybody should know. I mean, it's like the secret is hiding in plain sight. Mm. It's not a surprise that, you know, that they don't want to change the system in which they benefited. I mean, Bill Gates, at the end of the day, no matter how much humanitarianism he wants to do, he's still okay with a world in which somebody has $100 billion. I mean, that's not a world I'm okay with. And I think that, you know, and that one person and or the other 50 of these guys should be able to decide what to do with half of the humanity's wealth. I mean, that's absurd.
Yeah.
And so so that was that book. And the other book was I think it was Thomas Walker's Nicaragua, Living Under the Shadow of the Eagle. And it was about American imperialism in Nicaragua. And that story of just what we had done to that country, you know, which had tried in the 1980s, you know, in however problematic ways I learned later, but had still tried to, you know, build something for themselves and had tried to, you know, say, we can provide universal healthcare, we can provide, you know, schooling for free, we can, you know, we can grow our own food, we don't have to be dependent on the United States. You know, all of the things that actually development people were always talking about that they wanted to promote, they had tried to do. And what did we do? We, like, funded a guerrilla war against them. I mean, it was, and it was the same thing that, you know, I had learned later. Same time, same thing in Afghanistan. I mean, essentially that, you know, communists, again, however problematic, were trying to do something to change, you know, this really basically a feudal society in Afghanistan in terms of economic inequality and land holding. We're trying to change that and, you know, and maybe question capitalism. Not maybe, definitely question capitalism. And the United States was totally not okay with this. And they're like, we'd rather fund these Islamist zealots who will later turn on us, you know, sure enough. But we'd rather fund them and destroy this country and turn it into a civil war that has been going on for 40 years instead of actually, you know, maybe just letting people live. And I think that, so learning about those two things, I came back and I think I Skyped my mother and I told her, and I didn't Skype, actually, no, I Skype did exist, but I didn't Skype her. I sent her and my dad an email saying that, Mom and Dad, I think I'm going to study sociology now. I don't want to be an engineer because I want to understand, you know, the origins of poverty. And I think my mother, I mean, her English is very, very good. She corrects my grammar. But her email that she responded to, like, she was so distraught that it was incoherent. I mean, it was, like, totally incoherent. But the gist of it was, you're ruining your life. Like, this is the worst thing you could possibly do to study sociology or economics or geography or whatever I had said.
Thanks for listening to Life, the University, and Everything, a podcast of mostly academics brewing, sipping, or spilling tea. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or other places that you get your podcasts. If you like the show, leave us a review on iTunes, and also let the universe know on the socials. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at LUE Podcast. Submit questions for our not advice section to Life, the University, and Everything at gmail.com. Life, the University, and Everything is produced by E.B. Dresser Klutchman and, you know, thermodynamics and stuff. I'm Kat Gonzalez. Tune in next time.